Richard Quest. And right. Good evening, this is Truth Quest. And this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And tonight I have a guest on, Dr. Eric Carlstrom. I had him on last week, but tonight we wanted to kind of visit on something a little bit different. And it's he lives down in Crestone, Colorado. And at this point in time, the people in Crestone are dealing with something that has to do with some drilling going on with Lexham that wants to drill oil and gas wells, which may involve a wildlife refuge. And so what I think I will go ahead and do is bring him on, and then we can go ahead and follow through with the interview here. Eric?
Yes. Hello.
I can hear myself real well.
Okay, then let's just go ahead. I'll listen carefully.
Okay. Anyways, I had briefly introduced you to the audience as Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and that you have an issue taking place with the people in Crestone that that deals with Lexham and some oil and gas drilling that may be taking place on the wildlife refuge, and I thought maybe you can kind of follow it through from that point.
Okay. Yeah, I've been involved with a group which we call Water Watch Alliance here in the Crestone Baca area, and we formed about a year ago when it became known to our community that a Canadian gas exploration company called Lexham Explorations Incorporated owns the subsurface mineral rights beneath the newly formed Baca Fish and Wildlife Service, Fish and Wildlife Refuge, and wants to exercise their private property right by drilling two 14,000 feet deep gas exploration wells into the alluvium or the sediments beneath the San Luis Valley. And those two well prospects are just about a mile and a half to the west of our community, the Baca Grande. So our group formed. First, we were charged with the responsibility or the duty or whatever of trying to come up with a series of best management practices that could be written into the permit that Lexham was going to get from the Colorado Oil and Gas Commission. We did this because we were advised by people who had worked protesting big gas operations that you can't beat them, that the laws are all in their favor. They own the subsurface rights. So the best you can do is be nice and ask pretty please that they do it in as clean and undisruptive way as possible. And so we did that. We came up with a document called Best Management Practices Recommendations that we submitted to the newly formed Fish and Wildlife Refuge, and we did this under the name of the San Luis Valley Citizens Alliance. And most of the recommendations, I think, were passed on by Ron Garcia, who is the one person who basically runs the Fish and Wildlife Refuge. He passed those along to Lexham and also to the Colorado Oil and Gas Commission. And most of those recommendations were written into the permit. So Lexham now has a permit, and they have also done some extra seismic exploration. They've done some seismic testing. It's called 3D seismic. So now they have that in addition to a lot of 2D seismic data, as well as some information from other wells that have been drilled around the valley. And they think there's a reasonable chance, and of course this is a wildcat drill play, but they think there's a reasonable chance that if they go down way deep, deeper than anyone has ever drilled, maybe below 9,000 feet, which is where they think there's a geologic trap formed, which would trap the hydrocarbons, they think that they might be able to recover a trillion cubic feet of natural gas, or also known as a TCF, And we've heard various estimates as to how much money that might be worth, between $1 and $6 billion at the wellhead. So right now, this small Canadian corporation, this Lexan Corporation, is putting up about $20 million, or their shareholders are putting up about $20 million to drill these two exploratory gas wells with the hope of hitting it big and making, you know, maybe in excess of $1 billion. And, of course, our group now is concerned that this drilling could have very negative impacts to the wildlife refuge. Certainly, wildlife refuge is supposed to protect fish and wildlife, and yet this is not a very compatible use. They would be drilling right through pristine wetlands, which are very vulnerable. They'd be drilling through the unconfined aquifer, which is the source of water for our Baca community, as well as all the agricultural activities around here, as well as all the fish and wildlife depends on that water. And then about 100 feet down or so, there's a clay layer which separates the surface water, the unconfined aquifer, from a confined aquifer, which goes down thousands and thousands of feet and contains an enormous amount of water. And we're concerned that the drilling operation might contaminate this groundwater, which is a very, very precious resource, as you know, in the desert. And, of course, would also, in addition to water pollution issues, there's air pollution issues, there's noise pollution issues, there's all kinds of social impacts that would attend a gas operation like this, boomtown effects, could really radically change the nature of the whole San Luis Valley if they strike it rich. Then, of course, they would turn over the project to the oil majors. Now, Lexham owns 75% of the mineral rights, and the other 25% is owned by ConocoPhillips, which, of course, is one of the oil majors. And, of course, they are in a position to be a production company, whereas Lexham is an exploration company. So our little group is now trying to figure out ways to stall this operation and hopefully stop it, because we don't think that this kind of mineral extraction is at all consistent with the pristine quality of this valley and the reason why most of us came here in the first place. If they were to hit it big, of course, this would become kind of a industrial parkland, much as like they have around Silt and Rifle and other parts in the San Juan Basin in New Mexico, and in fact in the basins all around us, there's a huge gas industry land rush at the moment, which is being facilitated very much by the Bush and Cheney administration, because they in fact are all part of the fossil fuel extraction industry themselves, and are doing everything they can to expedite all the possible drilling on all federal lands, be it BLM, National Park Service, National Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife, you name it. This, when Bush got into office in 2001, he passed Executive Order, I think it's 13212, which mandates that every single federal employee on these federal lands expedite gas and oil drilling and remove all obstacles. So this is their mandate from the president. So this is why it's happening. And of course, we're starting to see a backlash. We're starting to see American citizens standing up for their public lands and saying, no, not on our public lands. But it's a very dramatic issue, and it's being played out all over the state of Colorado, all over Wyoming and New Mexico and parts of Montana, et cetera. This is now being turned into kind of a national sacrifice area, you might want to say, in terms of, you know, providing our electricity needs and our energy needs.
Is this kind of setting a precedent, or are there other oil and gas wells being drilled on wildlife refuges?
Oh, yes, there certainly are. And you can read about that in various, in various reports, non-governmental and governmental. And what's happening here is our situation is even a little worse than elsewhere, again, because Lexham actually owns the subsurface rights. Back in, a decade or so ago, the surface and the subsurface rights were severed from the surface mineral rights. And so while the U.S. government owns the surface rights in the form of the wildlife refuge, this Canadian corporation has a private property right on the mineral rights. So very hard to beat that in court, because as we were told by a lady who has fought the gas companies up around Sylvan Rifle for 4 years, you know, this is the richest and biggest single industry in the world, oil and gas, worth well over $1 trillion a year. And they have modified the laws over the last century so that that they're in their favor. Let me just give you a couple of statistics here. I put together some background information. There are over 2 million oil and gas wells that have been drilled in the U.S. As of 2002, there were about 520,000 producing oil wells and 360,000 producing gas wells in this country. And this is expected to double by the year 2012. The San Juan Basin of New Mexico has over 18,000 wells. And the Bureau of Land Management, again a federal agency, is proposing an additional 12,500 wells in just one portion of the basin. And by some estimates, at least half of the natural gas that can be produced in the U.S. has already been burned. That's very similar to the situation with oil. In fact, this country passed its peak production in 1970, and of course we've been relying heavily on imports ever since. And it could be that the world as a whole is now very close to this kind of magical number called peak oil, where half of the oil that's easily extractable has already been consumed and the other half is in the ground. And, of course, what that means is that those who control the oil and the gas control societies. They control the world because industrial societies run on fossil fuels. And it also means that as supply goes down and demand goes up, the price goes up. And those who control that resource then are in a position to make enormous profits. So anyway, right now the nation consumes, imports about 15% of the natural gas it uses. It imports about over half of the oil that it consumes as well. Colorado has undergone a real boom since Bush came to power, and has radically increased the number of new permits for oil and gas. In 2006, there were 5,400, whereas in 2004, there was 2,917. So Colorado is one of these states where the resource occurs and where the oil and the gas companies are booming. And in fact, I read in the newspaper that this oil and gas, I think, is now the number one product or number one industry in the state of Colorado financially. So that can't be ignored. But of course, when you have a beautiful, pristine area like the San Luis Valley, which is at the base of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains and is home to, you know, many spiritual communities here in Crestone, we have a lot of incentive to try to keep it pristine.
I've listened to numerous programs that have brought up the fact that maybe there's more behind this oil and gas boom in this country than meets the eye. And what is the history of Lexham?
Well, that's interesting. Lexham, the CEO of Lexham is an individual by the name of Rob McEwen, who is I believe he's certainly one of the very richest Canadians. He lives in Toronto. He's probably a billionaire. He was the CEO of Goldcorp Incorporated, which oversaw the development of the Red Lake mine, which is Canada's largest gold mine, and he probably made his $1 billion doing that. So this guy is a major player in the world financial markets, and especially in Toronto. Now, Lexham Incorporated, Explorations Incorporated, was incorporated in 1983, and it changed its name from Challenger Gold to Lexham when it went public. Now, Challenger Gold, under Rob McEwen, I believe, that was the previous name for it, also did some explorations in the San Luis Valley, but they were looking for gold. And they drilled in the southern part of the Baca and the northern part of what is now the National Park Service, the Great Sand Dunes National Park. And they did not find gold, but what they found, they claim, was oil shows, in other words, fossil fuels. Now, prior to that time, the conventional wisdom by all the geologists who worked in this area was that the Mesozoic-aged source rocks, such as Manca Shale, Dakota Sandstone, were not present under the valley. In other words, the geologic cross-sections that the geologists prepared based on their investigations showed that there was a large part of the geologic section that was missing from this part of the world, and that would include the Mesozoic and the Paleozoic rocks. And so all you had in section then was Precambrian rock at the bottom, which is much too old to have oil and gas, and then younger tertiary rock and quaternary sediments at the surface, and therefore very low probability of gas and oil. But recent work by some of Lexham's own consulting geologists suggested, at least to them, that this was worth taking another look. And I'm sure the increased price of gasoline also helped make that decision.
Dr. Carlstrom, would you please give your background? So maybe, I mean, you're using a lot of terminology that I don't imagine, unless you have a background in geology.
Well, I'm sorry about that. I am a professor of physical geography, and I teach courses in things like geomorphology, which is landforms and soils. I'm not a geologist, but I'm on the geology side of geography. And so, actually, I have taught courses in geology programs, and I have published articles in geology journals. So it's not a problem for me to read the geologic literature and to give you the basics. What I was talking about when I threw out words like Precambrian, Paleozoic, Mesozoic, and Tertiary, these are different kind of geologic time periods, and rocks are assigned to these time periods. And we know that the gas and oil industry especially knows that pay dirt for them is mostly in the Mesozoic rocks. That Mesozoic just means middle life. That coincides with the age of the dinosaurs. And so I was giving you those kinds of terms, and then the actual formation names like Manco Shale and Dakota Sandstone would be where the Manco Shale supposedly would be the reservoir rock, which includes the hydrocarbons, and the Dakota Sandstone would be, the Manco Shale would be the source rock, it's a little late, which includes the hydrocarbons, and then the Dakota Sandstone would be the reservoir rock, into which those hydrocarbons migrate and are trapped and are held because it has a certain porosity of 15% or something like that. And then the gas and the oil drillers need to find the right age rocks that hold the hydrocarbons. They've got to find a situation where those hydrocarbons have been trapped in, so they're looking for certain geologic structures like what we call an anticline, or this can also be accomplished by faults. And in the case of this valley, they think it's the faults. So the geology here was thought not to be conducive to large amounts of gas and oil. Lexham is taking a gamble that there are commercially sufficient quantities here, and they're going to gamble their $20 million or whatever in hopes that it might pay off with a major discovery of a trillion cubic feet or something like that of natural gas, which would be worth in excess of $1 billion. So from their point of view, this is a gamble. This is something people do with the money that want to make more money. So it's for this Canadian Toronto Stock Exchange. They don't know anything about our valley, and evidently they don't particularly care about our valley. But to go back to the history of Lexham. Lexham purchased 50% of the hard mineral rights from Baca Minerals in 1987 and the other 50% of the oil and gas rights on the Luis Maria Baca Grant Ranch, number 4, from the Newhall Land and Farming Company for $1 million. This is actually fairly cheap. It acquired the additional 25% of the oil and gas rights from the Baca Corporation in 1996 from Gary Boyce for another $1 million. So they spent $2 million to acquire 75% of the gas and the oil mineral rights on this land. It also owns various interests in oil and gas rights on land to the north and the west of the Baca Grande. And again, the remaining 25% of the oil and the gas is owned by the gas rights is owned by ConocoPhillips.
How did Gary Boyce get? From whom did Gary Boyce purchase the land?
Well, I think Gary Boyce would have purchased the land from Maurice Strong, another Canadian billionaire who.
With a background in petroleum.
Who has a background in petroleum. In fact, he made his money, I think, in Petro-Canada. He was the CEO of Petro-Canada, which is the main fossil fuel industry in Canada. And he, of course, made it in Alberta, where there's a lot of gas and oil. And Maurice Strong bought this Baca Ranch, tried to sell the water from underneath the valley, that is in the aquifers, to the Denver area, the Denver metropolitan area, and make $1 billion doing that. So he's a speculator as well, and he thought that the real gold, quote unquote, in the San Luis Valley was the water. And now Gary Boyce, when he took over the ranch from Maurice Strong, tried to do the same thing. Now both of those efforts were thwarted by local environmentalists who did not want to see their water being pumped over to Denver. Just as a kind of an aside, it's a little bit unfortunate that our group is pretty small, and for some reason our community is not rallying 100% to try to ward off this effort. I think the locals think that they're not going to find gas and oil down there, so why bother fighting them? We actually had a meeting with Lexham representatives a little while ago, and the vice president, the young vice president, was there, a guy named Ian Ball. And one of the Carmelite Catholics asked him, it was quite funny actually, Brother Thomas, said, listen, I don't know whether to get emotionally involved in this issue or not, so could you just tell me, and I used to be an accountant, so can you just tell me what the odds are that you'll find gas? And to which the vice president replied, between 5 and 15%, we guess. Okay, so let's guess 10%. They have a 1 in 10 chance. So this is what they're hoping to do. But let me go back and talk about AWDI a little bit. Lexham acquired the surface access and use by simple fee ownership and a surface use agreement with American Water Development Incorporated. That's AWDI. So Lexham got the surface access and surface use agreements directly from American Water Development Incorporated, whereas they got this in 1992 for $1 million. Whereas Lexham had acquired 50% of the gas and the oil rights, 25% of the gas and the oil rights from the Baca Corporation in 1996 from Gary Boyce, and he had acquired it from AWDI. Okay, so this particular agreement on the surface rights is binding for 20 years or until Lexham starts drilling.
This agreement
can be extended if there is production on the property, so that's why they're trying to produce. Now the surface rights were held for a brief time by the Nature Conservancy when the land was being transferred from Gary Boyce's Baca Corporation to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife. So there was a period there where the U.S. government was putting together the money to purchase it, and the Nature Conservancy acted as a middleman.
So is the Nature Conservancy a a government or third party? Who handles the Nature
Conservancy? Well, it functions as, of course, a non-governmental organization, an environmental group. But often, what we see more and more of, I think, in this highly privatized country of ours, is what we call public-private partnerships, where you have government working with corporations, or in fact, with non-governmental organizations to advance the agenda of those corporations. And the Nature Conservancy acted in this capacity.
Does not Maurice Strong have a strong background in these non-governmental organizations?
Well, yeah, I think, Melody, you know that he's very, very involved in promoting non-governmental organizations around the world and their importance in terms of international treaties and in terms of the United Nations. He has been a very, very highly placed figure in the United Nations. Some would say the power behind the throne of Kofi Annan or whoever is the head of the United Nations. And so he has a lot to do with he also had a lot to do with the environmental movement. He ran the first international environmental conference in Stockholm in 1972, and he was the director of the even larger Rio Earth Summit conference in 1992, in which most of the nations of the world made fairly significant agreements as to how to not only protect the environment, but to divvy up the world's resources. So this is a very powerful set of relationships. The United Nations, big Petro-Canada, big industry, and non-governmental organizations also.
And there are some that say that he's probably one of the more powerful players in the world.
Yeah, I've heard that said. He and David Rockefeller and various other people like that have an enormous amount of power. They're both getting older now, and one wonders exactly how powerful and involved they are. But he did live here for a while. His wife, Hannah Strong, still lives here, and she is presiding over the Manitou Foundation, which has been granting land that was once part of the Baca Ranch, but that went with her after Marie Strong sold part of the ranch to Gary Boyce. She's been donating kind of really beautiful parcels of land to spiritual communities around the world, and they have come here and kind of carved out a niche for Crestone as a United Nations of spiritual communities. She also is interested in the Manitou Foundation is a nonprofit, and it's also dedicated to sustainability issues. So at least on the surface, the Manitou Foundation is mostly interested in spiritual issues and sustainability issues. But again, there's a confusion about Marie Strong because he wears several hats, and one of them is as a developer and an oil and gas man and an industrialist and a capitalist and somebody who wants to make $1 billion selling water to Denver, and then he wears his environmental hat as well. So that becomes a kind of confusing picture for some of us, anyway.
Well, in the book Cloak of Green by Elaine Dewar, she does about a chapter interview with Maurice Strong, and I really was not aware that Canada was such a large player in facilitating these non-governmental organizations, and I was curious as to why she had picked Maurice Strong out. And the reason why that I'm asking these questions of Eric is because a lot of people think things take place in this world by accident, and this thing with that's been going on down there in Crestone area has been facilitated over several decades, and they used to have the meeting of the Trilateral Commission down there. If I'm correct, am I not?
Well, I don't know about that. I know that the Aspen Institute met here And that was also a very, very highly placed group of industrialists, including, CEO of ARCO and various other, government and industry figures.
You might be correct on that.
I don't know anything about the Trilateral
Commission. Okay, but there are some people who have had a very interesting history. and
the reason why, with the history, you mentioned the prior history of Lexham and why it would change from Goldcorp to Lexham, I thought kind of interesting, and that was why I was asking that.
Well, it changed from Challenger Gold to Lexham. Now, Goldcorp was a different corporation that Rob McEwen was heading up.
Oh, okay.
And he sold his interest in Goldcorp after they struck pay dirt and found the richest gold mine in the world. And now I believe he owns 51% of the shares, but he no longer directs the Goldcorp. So, this is a man with a lot of power and a lot of money and a lot of influence, and he's done it in mineral extraction and this kind of speculation. So while a lot of the people in this valley might think, oh, they're not going to find anything, I personally think these guys are, state-of-the-art, they're smart, they have the access to more geological data than anybody else with all the seismic work and well information that they have bought over the years. So I think that they think that there's a reasonable chance that they will hit pay dirt. Now, some people in the valley think that it's actually perhaps a water play in disguise. And because we know that there's a tremendous value to the water. But I still lean towards thinking that these people are, looking for gas, and the price of gas has gone up, and this country is running out of it, and we haven't moved towards the kinds of alternative renewable energies that we could and should have decades ago. So there's still a huge market for natural gas.
Now, I'm not an expert on that, but I've certainly heard enough discussions on some of the radio programs between certain experts saying that, maybe the petroleum isn't running out like it's being purported to be, and or, there's maybe a factor possibly that oil has now taken the place of gold for this country as the means for oil standard as opposed to gold standard. Have you heard any discussions like that?
Yeah, I've read some things about, and I've read little articles by this and that person about how maybe peak oil is a hoax and there's really lots of oil left. I really don't see much credibility to that. And you really have to look at a person's credentials, and when you see geologist after geologist after geologist saying, peak oil could be somewhere between, say, 2005 and 2035. Okay, that's kind of the range of estimates. That even includes the optimists at the U.S. Geological Survey. Okay, so peak oil is either here or it's coming down pretty fast. And to say that there's an enormous bunch of oil out there that they're not telling us about, I don't think that's very credible. In terms of moving from gold to oil, that's been done a long time ago. The world economy has been based on the petrodollar, and all because of the military might of America and the deals that our government has cut with Saudi Arabia and other OPEC countries. Up until quite recently, almost all the oil transactions in the world were based on the dollar, and they had to be. Now, Saddam Hussein wanted to break with that and sell his oil in euros. Well, it wasn't too long after that the United States invaded in 2003. So the petrodollar is a linchpin of American economic superiority and hegemony, if you want to use the word, in the world. And this has to do with a whole series of military arrangements and economic arrangements. But basically, they reflect the dominant influence of the oil majors, the ExxonMobils, the Chevron, the Texacos, the ConocoPhillips. These I'm reading an excellent book right now. It's called 100 Years of Oil Foreign Policy or something like that in the New World Order, and by a guy named William Engdahl. And what we see is we see what we call the Anglo-American Alliance, where the oil interests of Britain and the United States are controlling policy in those two major countries, and that those two major countries are controlling the economy of the world. At least 50% of the world's economy is controlled by the United States and Britain. So, and our oil companies are amongst, you know, the most powerful and profitable of all the interests. So, yeah, I would say we've been into the age of the petrodollar for quite a while.
And does Lexham deal with any other kind of resource?
Well, Lexham, this is a question that our little community asked. I'll just digress a little bit and say that on August 17th, the Fish and Wildlife and the Lexham representatives met with our local community, and we had a chance to ask questions and express our concerns. And this was a question that we asked them. And they were answering. What's the question one more time now?
Did Lexham have any other resource?
Oh, yeah. The young vice president said that they do have a uranium mine up in, I think, in Quebec or someplace like that. But Lexham is a fairly small company. In fact, several years ago, it was worth essentially nothing. But then when Rob McEwen got behind it again, then it started steamrolling forward, and this is the main project. And you can go onto their website called LexhamExplorationsIncorporated.com, and you can read about what they're trying to do here. And of course, that website is geared towards investors, but there's still a lot of information there. So I would recommend that. But I have to digress and kind of take you back to the story
right,
of
right.
where we're at in our little
okay.
community. On the 7th of August. Ron Garcia of the Fish and Wildlife Refuge sent out an email to about 50 of us in this community saying that Lexham, or that the Fish and Wildlife was going to start a scoping process and an environmental assessment process, and they were going to have the first meeting on the 17th of August. Now, that only gave us 10 days to get ready, and actually 9, because we got the message at 4:40 p.m., And so we did express our concerns, and at that meeting, and then we filled the room, and Crestonians expressed themselves very eloquently about all the potential negative impacts and how it was not a compatible use in this valley, et cetera. And Fish and Wildlife said, okay, please write us those comments, and then we will include this in our environmental assessment document. Now, the reason that they are doing an environmental assessment is because one of the local groups here, the San Luis Valley Ecosystem Council, in concert with the Water Watch Alliance, hired a lawyer to sue them to do a NEPA process. And NEPA is a law that was passed in 1969, National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA. And it's federal law that if a potentially damaging activity is taking place on federal land, the federal agency and the government has to do a NEPA process. And the NEPA process would include either an environmental assessment, which is a quick and dirty NEPA process in which they think there are no significant impacts, or if they think there are significant impacts, they are required to do an environmental impact statement, or an EIS, which takes longer. Okay, so when Lexham got the permit, the Fish and Wildlife Service here said to our groups and everybody they did not have to do a NEPA process. And the reason they did that is, I'm sure, because they were told from on high to expedite the drilling. Well, our lawyers sued them, and now Fish and Wildlife is saying, gosh, we need to do a NEPA process. But we want to do just an EA, an environmental assessment, which is a very, very quick and dirty version. And so what they did by calling the meeting and giving us only 10 days' notice, they're essentially trying to, I think, minimize the opportunity for locals to have impact and input into this decision-making process, which federal law mandates that we have to have input into. Okay, so at this last meeting, they said, okay, from this day forward, August 17th, you the community, you the public, have 30 days. Please write us all your concerns and your comments about the potential impacts of this operation to your community, et cetera, and send it to us. And I'll even give you the where to send it, because I certainly hope some of your listeners might be inspired to write to this address or email this person with your comments, because we're hoping to get 5,000 comments anyway in this 30-day period. Now, we asked for 45 days, but so far they haven't given it to us. So if you – and I've been working on a letter now for a couple days in which it's about a 10-page letter. I'm going to send it not only to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I'm going to send it to Senator Ken Salazar, Representative John Salazar, Representative Gail Schwartz. I'm going to send it to our county commissioners. I'm going to send it to everybody because I think it's going to be a good letter. But anyway, so if somebody out there in Radio Land would like to take this information down, we would very much help. Appreciate your help. The guy's name who works at Fish and Wildlife is Mike Blenden, B-L-E-N-D-E-N. His address is U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 9383 El Rancho Lane. That's 9383 El Rancho Lane, Alamosa, Colorado, 81101. And you can fax him at this number, 719-587-0595. That's 719-587-0595. Or you can email him, and his email is Mike, and then underscore, and then Blenden, B-L-E-N-D-E-N, at FWS.gov. That's Mike underscore Blenden at FWS.gov. So there's a 30-day deadline for comments, and then what the Fish and Wildlife proposes to do is they'll take all these comments, they'll write a draft environmental assessment, then they will, that'll probably take most of October, and then they will call another public meeting, one probably, and give us a chance to read the draft environmental assessment, and then we will make more comments, we'll have another opportunity, because the NEPA process mandates that the public be involved in the decision-making process, even though it's basically a sham, because it's a done deal. Actually, it's not a done deal. They want us to think it's a done deal, but there's a lot of pressure for it to be a done deal. But if the American people get involved and give overwhelming, strong input to our congressmen and our senators and our political leaders and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, I do believe that we can have an impact. And, of course, what we are trying to say now is that, yes, of course, there are very significant impacts. Of course, an environmental impact statement is required. It's absurd to think that an environmental impact statement is not required. And not only is that required, but the new Fish and Wildlife Service, the Baca National Fish and Wildlife Refuge, has not even completed its own management plan. It doesn't even know, it hasn't even categorized the fish and wildlife that it's supposed to protect. So we think it's absurd for them to allow this kind of threatening and potentially damaging activity on the wetlands without that kind of baseline data. So our argument is, yes, of course, an EIS is required. Of course, there are many, many, many significant negative impacts. Of course, a management plan is required first. But even more so, in my letter, and I think in many others, I'm going to be arguing that this should be a no-go zone. This should be preserved, just like the governor of New Mexico, Richardson, has now moved to save the Valle Vidal and Otera Mesa, two areas, down there that are in beautiful, pristine environments. And also, I might add, two areas where local environmentalists got together and pulled together to form these, you know, very well-organized coalitions. People have to respond. I mean, if in the absence of any opinions given by the American people, the oil and the gas industry is just going to roll over us and wreck our beautiful land, the reason why we're here, our pristine environment.
How did the water get separated from, or is it usually separated from the oil and gas?
Okay. That's a very good question, and it came up at we had a little oil and gas in the San Luis Valley Forum here a couple weeks ago, and a gentleman asked that question, you know, where's the document? Can we see the document where the gas and the oil, the mineral rights were severed? And in fact, there's a lawyer named Robin Cooley out of Colorado Springs that has been trying to get this kind of information through the Freedom of Information Act, trying to get these documents from people like the Nature Conservancy and others, and not having success. So there's a certain amount of secrecy involved in this whole process. And gee, if we had, you know, if our group, our Water Watch Alliance, and had more money, had some money, we're broke basically. We could start to get lawyers to pursue these issues.
So they don't show up at the water court.
I don't know about that. Do you?
There's a water court in Pueblo, and it is. I mean, I'm not. I know very little about either one, other than the fact that I've been to the water, if it's still there, you know, the water court down there, and I don't know what takes precedence over what, because you've got land, you've got now oil and gas separate from water, and if there was, you know, one person owned water and one person owned the oil and gas, who, you know, would stand precedent, because it sounds like those take precedence over the land rights. Am I correct?
Well, there's a couple issues here. The 1873 Mining Act gives superiority to mineral rights over surface rights. Okay, so there's a legal precedent that the subsurface rights are higher or more superior to. But then there's, of course, there's a whole series of water laws that have to do with the jurisdiction of that. And there have been, of course, lots of battles, legal battles about this. But basically, the water is owned by the state, Colorado. And this has come about in some, you know, contentious legal battles. As I understand it, now the Fish and Wildlife has access to that water and owns, you know, certain amount of that water for their own usage. But the state controls the most of the water in the aquifer. Now, in the San Luis Valley here, thus we're talking about, you know, tremendous value in the subsurface water and also potentially in the oil and gas. So in terms of the resources here, we're the third poorest county, and Sawatch County is the third poorest county in Colorado, and I've heard the 14th poorest in the United States. I don't know if that's true, but we may be sitting on tremendous value in terms of these resources, and so we can expect the big players, the big national and international corporations, to be eyeing us and making moves as they are and have been doing.
Well, I mean, it's got to be some precedent taking place here. Aren't there a lot of wilderness areas around in that area? If this takes off and they start finding oil and gas in more areas in that, would it be kind of like what's happened over in the Western Slope?
Well, could there be a land rush in the Baca, in the San Luis Valley? Absolutely, because there is a lot of private land. And, of course, ranchers will sell to, you know, oil and gas companies that offer them lots of money. But there is lots of public land here, too. And the Lexham owns, I believe they own the mineral rights as well under the new national park, the Great Sand Dunes National Park. I know they own the mineral rights under our Baca Grande community.
Well, doesn't it kind of appear then that, I mean, here you've got a Canadian company coming down to a, you know, an area that doesn't even have much of a history in it, in oil and gas, when they've got this huge expansive country of Canada to explore in, and you would figure that they would have, you know, much more, you know, possibility of finding oil and gas in that area. Why they would come down into this community and have 15, I mean, if I was betting and it was only a 10 or 15% chance, I would say that's kind of risky.
Well, you know, I think that the bigger issue you raise, I mean, how can a Canadian's property right on subsurface mineral rights be superior to the rights of American citizens and the U.S. government itself? Well, of course, this is all done with a long history of laws, many of which, of course, were you know, kind of bogus. I can go into detail on the rights of corporate personhood were extended in 1886 in the Santa Clara versus Southern Pacific Railroad case. For the first time, corporations, which are just legal fictions, were given the rights of personhood, i.e. the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of from searches and seizures. And this was a coup that made corporations much, 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 much more powerful than human beings could ever be, because a corporation never dies and it can't be thrown in jail, etc. So corporations now, of the greatest, the largest 100 economies in the world, 51 are corporations, not nations. So they're enormously powerful, and you see a lot of Canadian corporations that are extractive mining corporations in this country. And a lot of gold, a lot of silver in Nevada and California and Colorado, all over the place. It's almost like we are a colony of these Canadian corporations. And I think what it amounts to is kind of the dictatorship of foreign capital, and the notion that whoever's got the money owns the resources, no matter where they happen to be. And of course, the United States government has practiced this policy on behalf of American corporations all over the world for a century, and in all kinds of imperial adventures. Canada is now doing it here, and other foreign countries are doing it here. So in a sense, we're getting a dose of our own medicine, except that the American people were not ever responsible for this kind of neocolonial imperialism that our government's been practicing that was benefiting American corporations. And now it doesn't matter what country you're from. If you're a corporation and you got money, the laws are in your favor. And I think there are some real constitutional issues here. I think Americans should probably start waking up and trying to take back their country, or because we're going to lose it real quick if we don't.
Well, doesn't it, the possibility if this country is supposedly is in debt that they're claiming it is, aren't our resources and public commons going to be up for grabs? And I think that possibly this is maybe the first one in gets the best opportunity for resources and land if they just happen to be in the area.
Yeah, we're already seeing the Bush administration sell off large tracts of land from National Forest Service and the BLM, and I'm sure that this is on their agenda to privatize American public land. First to take land away from American citizens in order to make the land public, often with a kind of a green agenda, saying we're going to preserve this land for the fish and the wildlife, and then turn around and sell that land off to the highest bidder, saying, oh gosh, we're $9 trillion in debt or whatever we are, and whoever's got the money then can have this land. Well, that's the dictatorship of wealth. That's the dictatorship of the person who, in fact, prints the money. And that means the international bankers, because they do print the money for the whole world, and they do it out of nothing. And they've got quite a scam going.
Aren't you also running into some access problems down in that area, too, for people that live in the Crestone-Baca area?
Well, this is an issue that's just come up. It's kind of blindsided me, and I'm sure most people in Crestone don't even know about it yet. But there was an article, an editorial in the Crestone Eagle in the September 1st issue. Would you like to look at that and read that? Maybe that'll kind of set the stage a little bit. If, I don't know how your time is Melody, but
well,
if
we've
you
just
want
got about
to
4 minutes left here of this hour, and this, and I'm not sure which one it was. It says, "Write everyone now," and crisis or opportunity.
Well, okay, I'll just fill in. It's actually on page 2. It's an editorial by Kizan, our editor, saying we've got to talk. It came to her attention that a small group of Crestonians were making a proposal to the county commissioners that the three of the trailheads, and may, I've heard up to five of the trailheads, be closed to public access, the ones that go through a little corner of the Baca, because they would be going across somebody's private land or the private land of a spiritual group or the Manitou Foundation or something like that. And the fact is that, you know, over the decades and, you know, for a long, long time, hikers have been able to access our public lands and get up into the Sangre de Cristos here, which are quite beautiful, and, you know, go up these canyons and into the lakes and maybe even up to the peaks if they wanted. There's a whole series of trails that you can use. Some of them are in better condition than others. What they're proposing to do then is close off access to three to five of these, and they're saying that they represent the community in this, which they don't, and they're saying they also represent the wants and the wishes of the Park Service and the Forest Service, which I don't think they do either. So it's kind of a sneak attack. You know, let's sneak this through before anybody knows what's happening. And of course, you know, I'm a hiker and a climber, and that's one of the reasons that I'm here. And so I will do what I can to find out about this issue and try to keep the access to the public, because you know, I hike these trails all the time, and I meet lots of nice people, and most of them are just out for a day hike or a day climb, and they're not causing any trouble. And this is the great strength of America, is to have these public lands.
There's several. It's kind of like we're being shotgunned with numerous different issues all at once, and we didn't even bring up the Agenda 21, which Maury Strong seems to be a little bit involved with, and it appears that unless you read these global governance document or Agenda 21, and some of these. The Wilding of America, or there's a site called Taking Liberty by that Dr. Michael Kaufman has put on the internet. That's actually a PowerPoint presentation showing that there's numerous aspects that we may be having to look at where we're going to lose access to our public lands, and it could be through resources. It can be through these wilderness areas where there's only hikers and horses, but then as you're saying, you know, there may be some other factors to where even the hikers won't even be able to access these lands. So unless we're paying attention, there's a lot of things that are going on, and they're happening very quickly. Do you agree?
Well, I certainly agree. I mean, right now, Cheney and Bush are making noises about attacking Iran, for crying out loud, and they're using the same kind of disinformation, you know, in a media blitz to try to prepare the American people for that eventuality. When in fact, you know, Iran is is at least 10 years away from any kind of nuclear weapon, and all this, of course, is just a pretext for trying to control the oil in the Middle East, and which has, of course, been the Washington's goal for decades now, you know, since the 60s, or probably even before. So, yeah, I mean, there's so much happening right now. We talked last week about 911 being an inside job and a psychological operation against Americans. There's so many things happening, and what's happening, I think, is one of the things that's happening is Bush has been meeting more or less in secret with the presidents of Canada and Mexico to dissolve the United States and form a North American Union, which would be kind of equivalent to the European Union. So the international bankers want to move us towards trading blocks. They want to remove our national sovereignties. They want to tear up the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and they want to substitute UN documents that tell us that rights are bestowed upon us by the state They're not God-given, as our Constitution and the Declaration of Independence say. So, the New World Order is this gigantic international program to, in fact, move the world towards a one-world government, which will be run by the wealthy, by the corporations. And, of course, our government right now, in the hands of the Bush administration, is very much on board with this objective. And Americans really should read their Constitution. They really should read the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and they should try to hold on to these rights, because that's what separates us from being serfs and slaves.
And it's the ability to have private property. And if we lose if we're forced off of our lands because our economy has gone to heck, then who's going to be coming and pick up the pieces? Then we're going to be back, like you said, serfs.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I've done quite a bit of reading since 9/11 on all kinds of things, trying to educate myself about what's really going on in the world. And it turns out that the original statement in the Declaration of Independence was, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that amongst, these is, help me out here, that mankind is endowed by his creator with certain unalienable rights, and that amongst these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. It was not pursuit of happiness, it was pursuit of property. And the reason was because so many poor Europeans fled to the United States, they were not able, there was no way they could get their own property back in Europe, because they were in a feudalistic society where the few owned all the property and they were serfs. And so this American dream then is based on the average person owning his own home and his own land. And when we lose that, we're going back to being serfs and slaves.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Dr. Carlstrom, for the information about what's taking place in Crestone. And I really do think that there's a precedent taking place. There may be a lot more factors that are lying underneath the surface there, to kind of pun. If we don't get involved, and I think that's what this is all about, it doesn't matter whether it's down there at Crestone or here in Salida or wherever. Yeah, there's a lot going on, and if we don't start paying attention, we may not have the ability to say no, like we have had in the past. And you're right about, boning up on our Constitution and Bill of Rights. And I'd like to thank you. And did you have any closing comments? Or?
Well, I thank you, Melody. And I would just say, if anyone's out there listening, please consider writing a letter, baby steps, to the Fish and Wildlife Refuge, saying that, that there are many negative impacts of this, and that certainly an environmental impact statement is warranted, and a management plan is needed. And even consider this as a no-go zone to preserve it as one of America's really beautiful places. I think that, if we can get our government to observe the laws that are on the books, we're going to be relatively well off. But what's happening right now is that the government is considering itself above the law and is breaking so many of its own laws and not enforcing its own laws. For instance, under Bush, we've had just tremendous cuts into the federal bureaucracy, so that we only have one man managing the brand new Fish and Wildlife Refuge here, Ron Garcia. He's trying to do it all himself.
Okay, just a moment here. I need to say that this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and this is Truth Quest with Melody, and I'm interviewing Dr. Eric Carlstrom. Okay.
Okay. Well, the point I'm trying to make is that we have a government that has worked for a long time, and we have taken our public money and we've put it to good cause, like public lands, like administering Forest Service, Park Service, BLM, for the American people. I remember when it was free to go into national parks. Of course, it's getting more expensive all the time. And now what we're seeing, I think, is the very, very rich of the world, not just this country, eyeballing our public lands through the World Heritage Sites from the UN, biosphere reserves, etc., and the American people losing control over the, like you say, the commons, the things that we thought we owned by virtue of being Americans. And I would say that if Americans don't stand up and fight for those things, we're going to lose them.
Yes, and again, I would like to thank you, Dr. Carlstrom, and I'm going to have an interview with Charles.